All right, we've heard a little bit about recharge and infiltration. We're going to specifically move into stormwater infiltration in particular, that being engineered groundwater surface water interaction. The first talk is going to be tag teamed by Mike Trojan of the Pollution Control Agency. Mike is currently a hydrologist in the MPCA stormwater program. He's had a checkered career in the DNR's County Atlas program and also working on contaminant hydrology, Superfund program, and other things. And so he's currently emphasizing stormwater. And he will also be joined by John Guller of the University of Minnesota, specifically the St. Anthony Falls Fluid Hydraulics Lab, who has a long history of research in stormwater engineering. So, Mike.
Good morning. I'd like to thank Eric and MGWA for having me back, despite my defection from the groundwater world 7 years ago. Apparently, some people still think I'm okay. I apologize. I'm trying to get used to glasses. I can see depending on where I'm at here. So I added a question mark to my talk. It should have been there in the first place because without the question mark, it implies we don't know a lot, but we actually do know some things about stormwater infiltration. And hopefully by the time John and I get done talking today, we'll provide you with some information that might be helpful. Being an old groundwater person and now stormwater for about 7 years, I'm aware that within the two communities, there are concerns about what happens to stormwater when we infiltrate it, and there certainly is much more infiltration going on now than there was 10, 15 years ago. We do not have a slogan in the stormwater world, if it's brown, send it down. I just want you to be aware of that. But we do have some concerns, and I think that they need to be addressed. I talked to some hydros prior to this talk and found out and tried to find out what do people want to hear, and it occurred to me that a number of folks could really benefit from maybe a 100,000-foot level discussion of stormwater. So I'm going to spend some time with Stormwater 101, and I hope I don't bore too many folks, but I think it's important to have that background first, and then John and I will talk about impacts, potential impacts. John will deal with the water quality stuff, and I'll deal with the water quantity stuff. I should emphasize that when we talk about infiltration, we're talking about individual structures like a rain garden, permeable pavement, so forth. We're not talking about large infiltration systems. Those are different. At least I'm not. I don't know if you're touching on those or not. Yeah. So the average person, if you're sitting in your airplane, here's what you see. You see some roads and some parking lots and houses. A stormwater engineer might see this, a bunch of pipes with inlets and outlets. And when you put the whole system together, you end up with a urban conveyance system. Historically, what we've done in the stormwater world, at least up until the last 10 to 15 years, is we tried to get the water off the landscape. So we've short-circuited the source control and the water treatment portions of our system, and we would take the water from our impermeable surfaces and move them directly to a regional system, like a pond or whatever, and then from there it would be treated and we would do some rate control and we would put it in our receiving waters. The end result of that has not been always for the better. A National Science Academy report in 2008 came out and with a statement that past practices have been ineffective at protecting water quality and receiving waters, and now we need to more or less keep water as close to its source, as much of the water as close to its source as we can. So I'm going to go through a real brief overview of some of the infiltration practices. You hear things like low impact development, LID. The basic premise is we're trying to keep water, a good chunk of the water, close to the point where it falls or where it melts, and treat it there before it gets routed to a receiving water body. We have a handful of stormwater infiltration practices that I'm going to talk about. I'd like to emphasize the fact that we use a treatment train, or we advocate a treatment train approach in the stormwater world. These infiltration practices, and I'll say this a half a dozen times, These infiltration practices, like any stormwater practice, are primarily put in place for water quality purposes. And when I get back to water quantity issues, you'll find out that really hasn't been the focus of the stormwater world. It's not that we don't care about water quantity issues. Our primary goal has been to treat stormwater. And so these infiltration practices are treatment practices. The first one is probably the most common for most of you is rain garden, their bioretention. If they're designed to infiltrate water, we call them bioinfiltration systems. They have an organic media. They're intended to treat a small area, less than 5 acres in size, so they're not large. The one thing about them is they do, because of the organic media, they do a fairly good job of treating most chemicals. And John will touch on some of the concerns that we might have with these systems. But they have multiple treatment mechanisms, and therefore they're fairly effective. Tree boxes and tree trenches are really a variant on a bioretention system. If you walk down University Avenue around Snelling, where the light rail corridor is, you're essentially walking on top of an underground best management practice. Underneath you is basically a storage area, and these trees are tapping into that storage area. The water is infiltrating. It's being funneled from the impervious system underground into a system where it infiltrates, or it's brought up by the tree and evaporates. Any excess water gets shunted off the system, but this is in the Capital Region Watershed District, where they have a 1-inch infiltration requirement. So this is designed to capture an inch and basically move it into the ground or get it captured by those trees. One of the systems that we do have some water quality, well, maybe our most significant water quality concerns with are the infiltration trenches and basins. These are larger systems. They're often designed to take larger volume storms. They cover larger areas. They don't have that organic media oftentimes to treat the materials, and therefore pretreatment is required, where we try to remove 80-90% of the solids before we bring them into the system. That's for water quality purposes, and it's also to keep them from getting clogged. Permeable pavements, you're probably familiar with. They're kind of a hot new thing right now. They generally treat fairly small areas. They haven't really been proven yet in high volume, high traffic areas, although recent research suggests that maybe the certain designs are okay for doing that. Again, these don't have the organic media, and water can pass through them fairly quickly, and they do require pretreatment. Otherwise, aside from water quality issues, they will get clogged too. Swales and grass channels are really conveyance systems. Water's moving along these, but because it's in contact with soil, it can infiltrate water at the same time. So they can be designed to actually take in a fair amount of water, and they're typically vegetated systems. Earlier we had heard Lanny was talking about the shallowness of our turf systems. It's not just that they're shallow, but a lot of them are compacted also in urban areas. That's one way we can improve infiltration is by enhancing our infiltration into these turf systems, either by composting them or tilling them and ripping them or a combination of the two. We also have these disconnected systems where we can take runoff, say, from a roof, run it to a rain barrel, and from there onto a lawn or into a garden. Or in the lower left there, we're running water off an impervious parking lot and onto a grass area where we're allowing it to infiltrate. It was mentioned earlier, and I don't remember which of our two speakers mentioned, but we are seeing more and more, I think maybe it was Lanya mentioned, that we are seeing more and more local government units, and even at the state level, putting in infiltration requirements. The most common is a 1-inch infiltration or capture. It's actually a capture, but infiltration is by far the most common mechanism of capturing water right now. It's 1 inch of capturing. You try to capture that first inch off the impervious surface. So why 1 inch? That's the most common requirement that's out there. Well, if we can get that first inch, we're going to get about 90% of our annual volume of precipitation. We get much more diminishing returns if we try to capture more water, because you can see the steepness of the curve there. So if we want to get that 91st percentile, it's going to cost us a lot more money. What kind of regulations and guidance do we have in place? There are no effluent standards for discharges from stormwater infiltration practices. We do have 7060 on the books. We typically regulate through the use of permits. We also have some pretty good guidance, and the guidance is getting better all the time. EPA, for example, in the last couple of years, I believe, has put out this document, the EPA Brownfield Guidance, where they have guidance on how to infiltrate or when to or not to infiltrate around brownfields areas. MDH has some wellhead guidance, and we're actually have had a couple discussions with MDH in the past couple months about looking at their guidance and making sure it's compatible and links well with the guidance that we're providing in the Minnesota Stormwater Manual. And that's the document that I primarily work with, is the Minnesota Stormwater Manual. These guidance documents tell you when to infiltrate and when not to infiltrate, and when you do infiltrate, how you should do it. Just real briefly, I'll talk about the construction stormwater permit. If you disturb one or more acres of, if you put in one or more acres of new impervious surface in Minnesota, you have to have a construction stormwater permit. When you leave the construction site, you have to have practices in place that will capture an inch of runoff, unless there are restrictions, like if there's shallow bedrock or karst or whatever, then that you're not held to that restriction. But the construction stormwater permit requires that there's a 3-foot separation distance from the bottom of your BMP to the top of the seasonal high water table. It requires pre-treatment for your best management practices. It requires on-site soil testing, and there's guidance in the stormwater manual about how to do that testing. There's prohibitions for things like karst areas. And like I said, there is the stormwater manual. How many of you are familiar with the Minnesota Stormwater Manual? More than I would have guessed. That's a good thing. This is a typical page out of the manual. This is the page called Bioretention. There's several articles. This is in a wiki platform similar to, I can't think of it. Wikipedia. That's it. So, I wrote the stupid thing. You'd think I'd know. Not Wikipedia, I wrote this. although, is Al Gore here? Maybe I did write Wikipedia. Enough. All the blue pages here are blue links, are separate pages to other documents in the manual. And you can see, if you come in here and you're going to build a bioretention system, we have sections on how to design it, how to construct it, how to operate and maintain it, what kind of pollution credits or reductions you can expect from it. There's case studies and so forth, and there's CAD drawings and all that kind of stuff. And so that's the function of the Minnesota Stormwater Manual, is to provide that information to the engineers and the technicians out there that are building these things. There's also guidance in the Stormwater Manual on how to determine infiltration rates at a site, what to do with karst areas, although I had a discussion about that we can tell you don't do things in karst areas, but we don't tell you how to find the karst areas, and that could be a problem. Shallow depths to groundwater, what we call stormwater hotspots, for example, you might want to exercise some caution if you've got runoff coming off of a salvage yard. That might not be a good place to put a rain garden. We are getting some better guidance. We're working with a contractor right now, and we're going to have some future information on infiltration, general information. Wellhead protection areas, what to do with contaminated soils and groundwater, and mounding, which is an issue I'm going to talk briefly about it towards the end. So, is it truly a potpourri of known unknowns? And Randy, yes, I do have a slide with Rumsfeld. This said, we actually do know a few things, and so that's what we're going to talk about for the rest of the talk here. I'm going to pass it on to John now, where he's going to talk about water quality stuff, and then I'll come back and finish up with a few slides on the water quantity stuff.
Thanks, Mike. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the research that we've been doing at the University of Minnesota on water quality, as it is affected by infiltration. Okay. So I have some co-authors, Peter Weiss, John Niebuhr, Kelly Barica. Uh, And, you know, we're talking about infiltration and how much infiltration occurs and what sort of water quality you get out of infiltration. And then I'll talk a little bit about what we're doing to do research on the potential impacts. And finally, some conclusions before I give it back to Mike. So the water quality of runoff, I mean, this is in the literature. Maestri and Pitt in 2005 investigated the results of 3757 MPDES National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permits. So these are just data sent into the federal government. And they just had the quantity of numbers. And these are monitoring systems. So we know roughly what the quality of surface runoff is. And on the left-hand side, I have the median dissolved values. On the right-hand side, I have the national drinking water standards. That'd be the maximum discharge limit. And you can see that on the left-hand side, I have zinc, 51 micrograms per liter. There's no national drinking water standard for zinc. Copper, 8 micrograms per liter, and it's 1,300 micrograms per liter for the national drinking water standard. Cadmium, chromium, everything is quite a ways below. The key I'd like to point out is nitrates. Stormwater runoff has an average or a median of 0.6 milligrams per liter of nitrates, and the national drinking water standard is 10 milligrams per liter. So we are quite a bit below the national drinking water standard in the median values. But there are extremes. Stormwater runoff varies quite a bit in terms of water quality. And it's not location. It's storms. You have a big storm, you have bad water quality. When you have a little storm, your water quality is pretty good. Actually, if you see the runoff from the melt, you go by the walking, take your dog for a walk by the curb, and what you see is pretty clear water. There's not much particles in that water. But if you have a storm, that'll be pretty dirty water coming down. So the big difference is in storms. They've done it in terms of location. They've done it in terms of industry. They've done it in terms of land use. And it's really different all over the country, everywhere. And it's primarily the difference in storms. Oh, I want to talk about this slide a little bit. Now, on the right is the coefficient of variation that was used to determine the median value. So the coefficient of variation is the standard deviation divided by the mean value. And these are huge coefficients of variation. 4.6 for zinc, that's tremendous. That means your standard deviation is 4.6 times your mean value. So you have a huge scatter. 2 is a huge value of a coefficient of variation, and there's nothing that's really less than about 1.5 for chromium. And that's an indication of what I was saying, is that the storms are causing the variations, these huge variations. They didn't track chloride. Chloride's a big issue in Minnesota. So it's difficult to treat. I don't know how to treat it except dilute it. Novotny and Stefan say that two-thirds of the road salt stays in the Twin Cities Basin. So two-thirds of what we put on the ground does not leave the basin through the rivers and creeks. It stays here. So that's going someplace. There are TMDLs for chloride in the Shingle Creek and other places. This is a groundwater-surface water interaction. The groundwater is flowing into the surface water. This is during base flow. Shingle Creek has a TMDL. That means that they have exceeded the level at which they should be. And the maximum level for drinking water is 250 milligrams per liter, which is about the same as it is for aquatic life. Basically, that means you have salty water. Viruses are a problem in groundwater. I didn't I didn't know about this until I went to a seminar, really didn't know about this until I went to a seminar on Friday. But 46% of Minnesota relies on non-disinfected groundwater for drinking. That was Mark Borchardt gave us a seminar. And here's a shock, 22% of acute gastrointestinal illness was from contaminated groundwater. 22% of the stomach flus come from contaminated groundwater. That'd be 22% of the 46%. It's believed to be caused by septic systems and leaks in sanitary sewers. And we don't have a clue what the influence of groundwater infiltration is. But there are viruses in runoff. Here's a source of viruses right here. I don't know of many bird flus that have gone around except the one that was well publicized that came from someplace in Asia. But it is possible that you can have a virus transfer from a bird to a human. This is not our biggest source, however, of viruses in stormwater runoff. This is our biggest source. And the reason is because they live where we pipe the water. They live in the sewers. Looks like they're just about to, they've chased the dog away and just about to enjoy some lunch here. So, what are we doing to investigate the potential impacts? Well, surface infiltration with organic compounds in the soil. My theme will be this. Organic compounds are very important for water quality because the things that could pollute the groundwater quality are metals, things like that, primarily metals, hydrocarbons, and things like that. And organics are really good at absorbing those, the cations and the hydrocarbons. So there are surface organic compounds in the soil. These are engineered products and things that are where you have plants growing. They have to have surface, they have to have organic compounds in the root zone. So rain gardens, infiltration basins, and swales, those types of things. This is the same rain garden that Mike just showed. And then I don't know about infiltration trenches. They may or may not release water at that level in the root zone where you have organic compounds. Pervious pavement may or may not release water in the root zone. You might not have a root zone under pervious pavement. So to investigate the impact, we did some Collins studies. This is basically the root zone impact of the soil. So we took some water, put it into a column. The first thing we do is fill the column with 30% compost and 70% sand like you might for a rain garden. And we found that breakthrough occurred after 507 meters of water for zinc and for cadmium and after 935 meters of water for zinc. That's a lot of water. And so your organic compounds are absorbing a lot of these chemicals. What we did is we put in a typical concentration because we know the concentrations. I just showed you the concentrations of stormwater. So we put in the median concentrations of stormwater and ran a lot of water through. It took that much water. Of course, a rain garden or an infiltration basin is going to get more than the rainfall because you have roughly a 20-to-1 ratio. So they get 20 times the rainfall that falls on the streets because they're taking the water from 20 times their area. But still, the time to break free was fairly large. I mean, you know, 79 years for cadmium. Now, these are under laboratory conditions, so it's not necessarily field-type conditions. Things are always different in the field. But you have the potential to have a long breakthrough. Cadmium, 79 years. Zinc, 145 years. And it's true for most cations. Most metals. So we went out to the rain gardens and we investigated. I hope this shows up. We investigated how much was in the rain garden, how much was retained by the rain garden. And you can see it's very dependent upon the organic composition of the rain garden. The dashed line is the organic composition of the rain garden, and the two other lines are are zinc and copper. And you can see especially the zinc goes up when the organic compounds go up, the organic content. RWMWD5 in the center on the bottom is a pretty strong correlation, as is the upper left, UMN1. They are all correlated more or less. So the metals are being absorbed in the top part of the rain garden. These are centimeters. So this is like 4 centimeters, the upper 4 centimeters of the rain garden. That's just, you know, less than 2 inches are absorbing the metals. Now, what you do after that when you have to take the rain garden out is another story. That's something I haven't actually worked on and haven't thought about. The same thing is true of hydrocarbons. Now, this is a graph where you have hydrocarbons in unplanted rain garden media, grassed rain garden media, and clover rain garden media. So the left is unplanted, the right is clover, and the center is grass. And the sorbed compounds, these are hydrocarbons, these predominantly petroleum hydrocarbons. The sorbed compounds are the dark bar on the far left. This is a fairly short-term study, so most of what we had was adsorbed onto the roots of the plants and the organic compounds in the media. But they're actually, considering with such a short-term study, you know, maybe one growing season, there's quite a bit, and the roots were not developed that well during that season, there's quite a bit that was mineralized, that means turned to carbon dioxide, and that would be the second dark bar with roughly 10 to 15% up to 20% with the clover was mineralized. Now, the amount that went through is the first light-colored bar that would be leached. Leached went through, so the unplanted had 20% of the hydrocarbons went through this media. The grass media had 8%. And the clover had 8%. Only 8% of hydrocarbons went through this media. And these were not really overgrown that much. They were just kind of establishing plants, the kind of thing you might have in year one, not in year 10. So what that means is that the plants, the soil is absorbing the hydrocarbons that are moving through. The plants are pulling the hydrocarbons out of the soil. The plants are actually mineralizing the hydrocarbons and turning it to CO2. So the hydrocarbons are disappearing when you have planted soil, which is a good thing. So these are kind of some conclusions about organic material and surface infiltration. I didn't talk about this, but particles and bacteria are filtered by the soil. That's the filtration aspect that many people talk about in terms of soil. Organic material in the soil is absorbing many of the metals and the petroleum hydrocarbons, which is also a good thing. So rain gardens do a good job, infiltration basins, swales, because they're all planted. Bacteria near the roots will degrade hydrocarbons, so that's actually a huge plus. But there are some questions. First, nitrate will be released by degrading organic materials. The compost releases nitrate because compost is degrading organic material. You put compost in a rain garden, you put compost in when you're building soil to do something like put a swale in or something like that. And compost releases nitrates and phosphorus. Now, phosphorus is not a big deal when you're worried about groundwater, but it is a huge deal in surface water. Nitrates are something of importance. The nice thing is that nitrates still are not that high. They still are not a big concern for groundwater because stormwater runoff is, like I said, 0.6 milligrams per liter. And chloride will pass through. That's a huge problem that we have in the Twin Cities. Our chloride is not going flushing into our rivers. Our chloride is going into our groundwater. And viruses will pass through. So we need to consider chlorides and nitrates in the groundwater to see how important they are, and then disinfect for viruses. Now, I talked a little bit about, I've been talking about surface infiltration, and underground infiltration is something that Mike mentioned that they are concerned about. And I think that in terms of groundwater, it is something to worry about. For that reason, we are working on it. There is not much research. You can't say that you're going to have your metals removed or your hydrocarbons removed or anything removed because you don't know. These are all important in terms of the groundwater contamination due to underground infiltration. Underground infiltration will become more prevalent. You can put these things under a parking lot, so you can put them, they don't take up any space. And in the metro areas, the space is expensive. These are more expensive to build. But once you've got it built, you can put a lot of water in there, and you don't take up any space. So I think they will be more common. So some of the current research we're doing is monitoring. We have an infiltration basin with five bottle samplers placed at the surface and seven lysimeters placed at depth. We have a rain garden. It's a fairly large rain garden with five bottle samplers and three lysimeters. The bottle samplers are typically to sample surface water. And an underground chamber, which has 10 sumps placed above and below the underground vault. So, and this is what we're measuring. We're measuring metals, nitrates, chlorides, petroleum hydrocarbons, and total phosphorus. So this is what one of the installations looks like. This is the Sheets Pasture infiltration basin, which is right over here. So we have some water, some surface samplers. These are the bottle samplers. And then we have some lysimeters placed at up to 9 feet of depth. 9 feet of depth is a very deep lysimeter for us. Here's the rain garden. We have five locations in the rain garden, similar in the Sheets Pasture infiltration basin. Let me see. You can see them in the as green dots there. Same idea in the rain garden. This is at Hamlin Midway, right next to Como Park. And then at Beacon Bluff, they have built some underground chambers, three 12-foot diameter underground chambers. They have placed them underneath shredded tire strips. They have a surface infiltration system above them. It's actually fairly complex. The flow of water is fairly complex. Most of the water does not come from the surface infiltration basin. Most of the water comes from a neighborhood nearby that flows into a pretreatment pond and then straight into the chambers. And here's where they have these barrels for sampling. Now, this is a monitoring study, not a laboratory study. I once said that I would never do any monitoring because it's just terrible to deal with the data. I mean, you don't know exactly what you got. And now I'm doing all kinds of monitoring, and I'm wondering why am I doing this. But you get in the field and you have to monitor. So once you get things developed in the lab, you have to go out in the field and you have to monitor. But you have to be very careful about how you do things. So the nitrate concentration, these are what we measured. What we did is we had difficulty sorting out. We're trying to pull some information out of the monitoring data. But one thing that we can show is that if we throw all the data, this is data from deep, from the nine feet deep lysimeters versus surface samplers, there's really no trend with depth. Possibly we are monitoring different quantities of water, different types of water. But if we throw them all together, what we find is that 3% of the nitrate samples are above the MCL for drinking water. So that's not very high, 3%, but it's still a certain percentage that can be important. Of course, it's difficult to get the nitrate concentration higher once again it's in the groundwater unless you're diluting it with high nitrate concentrations. So it will be diluted over time. I don't feel as though it's a huge problem. The other thing we found is that lead is above the MCL drinking water limits 9% of the time, which is kind of, I see this as a legacy of our use of a leaded gasoline. It's still in the ground. Lead likes particles. It hangs on to particles very tightly, and it's slowly coming off the particles. And like I said before, here's the big problem. Chloride concentrations at 22%. 22% of the time, this is take samples over the entire year, and 22% of those samples exceed the MCL for chloride. So we have a problem right now in chloride in our surface groundwaters, and it is impacting our streams. Eventually, if we just keep it up, it will impact our drinking water aquifers. So the concentrations, and these are some conclusions, temporary conclusions. The concentrations in stormwater are not that high compared to drinking water standards. Local hotspots can occur, and this would be over time, not necessarily over location, except in cases where you have an industry right above it. Intense storms result in high concentrations. And surface infiltration would likely retain metals and degrade petroleum hydrocarbons, which is a good thing because of the roots and the organic material. Nitrates and chlorides are a concern, mostly chlorides, I believe, and possibly viruses, but they're already in the groundwater. And underground infiltration needs to be studied. So thank you. I'll give you back to Mike Trojan.
Wait a second. I didn't get an applause when I passed it on to him. Thank you. You're probably applauding because I'm getting close to the end here. Okay, do I have a few minutes yet? Or?
A few.
Okay, I'll try to go quickly. I'm just going to touch on some of the water quantity issues. Like I mentioned earlier, we haven't historically treated, our BMPs are intended to treat the water quality, and they haven't really been designed to address water quantity issues, but obviously there are going to be some groundwater hydrology, hydraulics issues that we're going to have to think about at least. In theory, if you have a rain garden, for example, here that treats 1 acre of impervious surface, you could run 39 feet of water through that rain garden in a year. That's obviously a very highly focused infiltration system, and that's what we're talking about with stormwater BMPs. And as I heard the talk about karst, I was thinking, oh my gosh, what if there's a buried sinkhole underneath this thing? So, you know, we do have some things to think about. One of the things is groundwater mounding. You're always going to get a groundwater mound under a stormwater infiltration practice. It could affect local structures, wells, and so forth. There is some guidance out there. New Jersey has some guidance. if you're relatively shallow, your structure is shallow, or your contamination is shallow within certain depths, you have generally limited concern. But as you move deeper into, if you have contamination deeper in the aquifer and you don't want to mobilize it, if you have a deeper structure, you're going to have to start doing some investigations and site investigations before you put in your infiltration practice. This is a result of some USGS simulations. They use the Hantouche method, which is an analytical method. And even for a 10-acre site, their median rise in mounding beneath this infiltration practice was less than 2 feet. But you can see tremendous variability, and it's a function of the permeability of the materials underneath. Same thing with the spread of the mound. It generally spreads less than 50 feet even for a large system, but you can get tremendous variability. Real briefly, in a study by Thompson and others, they suggest they found that lower aquifer conductivity and soil permeabilities are by far the most important factor. Moving through it fairly quickly, but the last two bullets, you notice that the configuration of your infiltration practice can't affect the amount of mounding. If you have a circular or a square system, you're going to get more mounding than if you have an irregular system. Studies suggest that these larger systems that both John and I have been talking about are probably going to be the primary concern. If you think mounding is going to be a concern, you need to go out and you need to get good data on your unsaturated zone, and you need to find out where your water table is before you put in your infiltration practice. There isn't much on groundwater recharge. I found a couple studies. These are modeling studies. One study in L.A. Investigated if you implemented a full three-quarter inch infiltration standard across the L.A. area, you would get about a three-inch of recharge per year. A similar study in Boston found about 3.6. If you take that rain garden I showed a little bit earlier and ran 39 feet of water through it, made some assumptions that Lanya talked about and so forth, you could end up with about 2.5 inches. So, you know, these, in terms of the numbers that Lanya was showing, these are pretty significant numbers, I think. You know, we're looking at 10 or 25, maybe 50% in some cases of what you're getting now for recharge. What are the effects on aquifers? Again, these are very complicated modeling studies. One study in Philadelphia showed that over several decades, you could get a 3 to 6 foot rise in your water table. Another study in Syracuse, you could get a 7 foot rise. These are maximum elevation rises. But these are for deep aquifer systems, too. So the shallower your aquifer, the less rise you're going to get in your water table. The bottom line is we just really don't understand this much because this has not been the focus of the infiltration work in the stormwater community. Can stormwater affect base flow? Well, it depends. I mean, does urbanization really decrease base flow? This is an excellent paper I'd recommend for people interested in this topic. Hamill did a study, and he found that only about one-third of the cities and urban areas where they did studies did they actually find decreases in base flow as a result of urbanization. In another third, they found no change in base flow, and in another third, they actually found base flow increased as a result of leaking infrastructure. What's the goal? Is it pre-development? We've modified our streams in so many different ways. Can we ever reach a pre-development goal? What indicator are we going to use? Is it a low flow? Is it Q90? Is it a median flow? What is it that we're after? Do we consider anthropogenic effects in our base flow calculations? Do illicit discharges count? It's very complicated, and a study at Hamill and Fletcher, they chose low flow as their metric, and what they found was that localized structures alone, rain gardens, permeable pavements, so forth, cannot return base flow to its original low flow condition. If you're going to, and this, you can't extrapolate this to every study, this is just one study, but what they found is if you're going to try to, in this particular study, if you're going to get back to original base flow, you have to have enhanced recharge. It has to be a focus of your infiltration efforts. And right now, our infiltration efforts in stormwater are not focused on base flow or groundwater hydraulics. They're focused on water quality treatment. Some current strategies. Current infiltration practices are not consistent with promoting base flow. And this is very complicated. This is a study that Tricia Moore and John participated, John Niebuhr at the university. They looked at effects of base flow from infiltration practices in Minnehaha Creek and found a buried bedrock valley that was controlling the system, and essentially the infiltration systems were recharging the deeper groundwater system, I believe, rather than enhancing base flow. So what next? I don't really have any conclusions other than maybe some suggestions about where some areas we could study. I think there's a lot of work going on in individual control structures right now. John was talking about that, and it's not just the work that John's doing, but it's happening all across the country. We're starting to get better data for water quality stuff related to rain guards and so forth. Where we don't have good information is on the hydrology and the hydraulics, and that's where I think there's a lot of collaborative opportunities between the stormwater and the groundwater folks. We really kind of need to have the groundwater community push us a little bit on this issue, because it's not on our I'm not going to say it's not on our radar screen, but it's not the focus of why infiltration is happening in the world of stormwater. Having said that, it's extremely complicated, too. If we're going to use a metro model or something, we've got to get a good handle on what infiltration actually is occurring and how much of that infiltration is actually getting down deep into the groundwater system. And as Lonnie alluded to, that's just not a simple thing to do. It's very complicated. And with that, I don't even know if we have time for questions, but that's it.
I'm gonna stretch it a little bit and allow like one or two questions, but I get to ask the first one, which is, when you get that breakthrough, is there some protocol for either regeneration or like scraping that top layer off and doing something? I mean, what's the lifetime on some of these, for instance, rain garden? Has that been looked at?
Well, usually a rain garden is built with an idea that the lifetime would be 10 to 20 years. It's hard to say how long they would last if you had it working properly.
Then you excavate it and rebuild it?
Right.
Okay.